I'm Erling Torsted, and this is the at least Washington-famous Holden Forum. And every time I hear the word forum, I think of the newspaper some of you know in Fargo called the Fargo Forum, but it is affectionately known as the Fargo Foolum. And I don't know if we're going to have any Foolums tonight, but I think we might have a good discussion, and I'll sort of alert you ahead of time. And Barb read this, that what I would really encourage this program to be is a sharing of stories about whatever any of us want to say about why we work, how we work, what it means to us, what we think about it, what it's done for us, any interesting stories and anecdotes. Because what I've learned at Holden, just as I've learned with talking in Northfield to the retired ministers, for instance, and to elder hostels and the rest, is there is an enormous amount of accumulated stored wisdom in audiences that's really worth sharing and really worth bringing out. And having completed now my 30th year in the classroom, I'm tired of listening to myself talk, and that I would be delighted if you, after a few introductory and I hope appropriate remarks from this end, would be able to pick up and start, you know, telling your story, because this is one of, I think, the real strengths of Holden. I remember once, three, four summers ago, and for one of the summer programs, we planned just bring your favorite story. And the young people who had been brought up on television didn't realize just how exciting and how much fun simply telling good stories was, and they wanted to have another session, you know, right away. And I think we all have good stories to tell, and I think every story is as good as every other. I'll grant you that Garrison Keillor tells his stories better than others, but I don't think that his stories are necessarily qualitatively any better. And I think we're fortunate to be able to have somebody like Keillor to inspire us and give us some direction and momentum on storytelling, because I think some of my colleagues at Sinoff tell me he's probably the best storyteller in America since Mark Twain. And I wouldn't want to challenge that at all. And he tells a lot of stories about growing up and about the work and some of the others that I would like to encourage you to think about and tell you yourself, because I remember I got interested in all this. My grandmother was living just two houses away, and in those long winter nights before we had television, she would invite me over and we'd play Chinese checkers, and she'd serve me some Kool-Aid, and then she'd tell me stories about living out in the frontier. And at the other Holden, there is another Holden Lutheran Church where all my ancestors are buried, between Kenyon and Winnemingo in Minnesota, and I feel like I have this wonderful connection between the two Holdens. And I'm always delighted to take my Holden, this Holden friends out to see Holden Lutheran Church out in Winnemingo Township, and it's a great place, and I'm very, very fortunate to have been able to been, you know, brought up there, and we learned to tell stories. Uncle Hulver could tell some great stories, and I hope that will encourage some of you to tell your stories. As I say, just a little bit about this. We planned this program tonight because maybe some of you have forgotten this is Labor Day, and you can think back all the things back that you would be doing or wouldn't be doing. I know I would be getting lesson plans ready today. It's Labor Day is right for us. Teaching, we would do lots of laboring on Labor Day, and some people would be, boarding up the cabin or bringing in the boat or some of the other things that go along with Labor Day. But we thought it would be a good chance to reflect on this, because there is such a strong connection, and I want to say just a couple of things about this. There is such a very strong connection between our faith and our work, and we can trace that back to somebody who is thought of highly here, somebody named Martin Luther, who made a tremendous contribution not only just to the Lutheran thing, but to all of what we would call the Western tradition, because he was one of the very first who broke through the idea, the older traditional idea, that the only work that was really pleasing to God was the work that was done, you know, by the clergy, or the work that was done by the priesthood. That the surest way to heaven, you remember he saw it before he broke, the surest way to heaven was what he called the way of the cowl, or the way of, you know, of the priest. And Luther broke through all that very clearly, and had some wonderful things to say about the dignity and importance of work. Somebody can correct me on this, but he said this wonderful statement about he would rather have a cobbler make the best possible shoes and let it go at that than have a cobbler and make his statement about his faith through making the best possible shoes than designing and putting crosses on shoes, as though that was necessary to indicate to the world that you're not a Christian unless you put crosses all over your shoes and hand them up. But Luther was very important in that, although he never really got past what we would call the medieval economy in terms of what his successor, John Calvin, took up later. And Calvin was really the one who founded what we still like to call today the Protestant, sometimes it's called the Puritan work ethic, where one worked as a sign of evidence of grace from God, and one worked not necessarily to to prosper in life, but one worked because God had richly endowed and blessed this person or this group, like in Boston, for instance, or some of the other New England places, and that one was only returning thanks and one's gratitude to God on the basis of what God had given them. And they believed so strongly that God had done this and that they had to please God by their efforts that they became extremely determined not to fail, because to fail in their work, to fail to develop being the best, you know, people in farming and fishing and business and all the rest, was seen as a mortal sin to them, because God had given them this kind of responsibility, and therefore they dare not fail, because that was as much of a sin as theft or, you know, arson or any other murder or anything else like that. And that idea really stuck in America for a long time, and I suppose that idea, rather than the Lutheran idea or the Catholic idea, was the one that dominated and probably shaped this unique thing we call free enterprise capitalism in our country today, which is so important, you know, for all of us, and which has come to shape the values, you know, of almost, not almost, of all of our institutions, our churches, our schools, our, you know, our government, business, all these things, really in a very real sense are shaped by what we do. And I would just like to start off by giving a story I learned, and then I hope you tell your stories, and we've got lots of time here. A story I heard when I graduated from high school, 1948 in Kenyon, Minnesota. And the speaker told the story that life was like a farmer taking a load of apples to market, and that there were lots of bumps and curves and ups and downs and pitfalls and dangers and snares and all sorts of temptations and tribulations, and he stung it out much longer than I can here with these sort of things. But at the end of the road, when you finally got to market, the big red apple juicy ones were right on the top where they belong, and the little runty wormy apples were right on the bottom where they belong. That, in other words, that you got what you deserved in life, and that everybody in a very real sense had a very real chance to succeed in life if only they would work hard enough, and that if you worked hard enough, you were bound to succeed. And I had a chance just a few years late, not a few years later, it was this fall, I mean this last spring, I had a chance to talk to the FFA, that's Future Farmers of America, and I told them this story, and then I ended with, you know, it ain't necessarily so. And I would like to suggest that probably one way in which we get our faith and our work together, if not necessarily always in the best possible way, is to think that God expects of us to do our very best. And the problem in we're living in a capitalist society such as we have, our very best means to maximize profits. That's the payoff. I mean, that's why you go into business. You don't go into business to lose money. You go into business to maximize profits, to get ahead. And therefore, and then another old townsman of mine, he in Northfield, Thorstein Veblen, picked up on this very nicely. And he argued that what happened then was that people decided that the way to show how important and worthwhile and intelligent and self-disciplined and all the rest of these wonderful things that they wanted the world to see was to succeed, you know, in their occupation. And hence this incredible pressure, obviously, to succeed as a way of demonstrating to the world how much as I say, self-discipline, you know, what we call the denial of instant gratification is a good way of putting this, we are really capable of. And hence, I think there's a strong indication in America that many people really believe that that's the best statement they can make to the world about who they are and what they hope to have accomplished in this world. To leave something highly successful in terms of how the world evaluates, you know, success. So, I don't know if I put you to sleep or what by that little opening, but it's only five after, and that's for me, and Elmer and some of the rest of you Regal Beautles over here have heard me before. Well, no, that's astounding for my introductions. Usually it takes about, like with bicycle riding, it takes me about a half an hour to warm up on my bicycle, and at least 15, 20 minutes to get warmed up here. So whatever anybody wants to contribute, yeah, Deanne.
I heard a story about an old man who lived down in the South who, by terms of the world, was not very successful. He wasn't impoverished, but he didn't have a lot of these things that we tend to measure success with. You know, no big house, no brand new car, none of this stuff. And he even felt he was a failure as a Christian because he came from a Baptist tradition and he had never won any souls for Christ. Well, finally, in his 70s sometime, he finally won somebody for Christ. And that person was Billy Graham. So I would say in God's economy, that gentleman was very successful.
I was hoping there'd be a few more hymn books here, because one of my sort of minor joys in life is to sing and listen to some of the great old gospel hymns that we don't find in the Lutheran tradition anyway. And the one that I've used for the title for tonight is "Bringing in the Sheaves." You know, "We shall come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves." And that doesn't mean we shall come rejoicing, relaxing, or taking 2 days off every week, or living off the interest or anything else. I mean, you work all the time. And my particular favorite, is "Work, for the night is coming. Work through the morning hours. Work while the dew is sparkling. Work mid springing flowers. Work when the day grows brighter. Work in the glowing sun. Work, for the night is coming when man's work is done." Sort of shape up, boys, because pretty soon you won't be able to work any longer. But that fulfillment in life, what they're saying in that hymn, comes through your work. Comes through what you're able to do and contribute to, to society itself. And obviously there have been ups and downs with that. In the 1960s, I think many young people in this country simply opted out of what we call the work ethic and chose another entirely different way of life. I'm wondering, do you think there's a generation gap between most of you are not Luther Leaguers any longer, so say that. Do you think there's a generation gap between you and, say, children or your grandchildren in attitudes towards work? Okay. Would anybody want to elucidate on that? There's a real generation gap, and then what it is and what you think has caused it?
I wouldn't lay it to a generation. I think it's become a part of our expectations, and it's been put into the law of the land under the entitlement programs.
The entitlement programs, such as Social Security, or?
Well, there's a start.
Okay.
Some of the others are, we think of.
If you're a widow with a child, you get a certain allowance. If you have two children, you get more allowance, so why not have three? And the husband is not really very important.
Okay.
Except procreate a child.
So you think that there's a lack of incentive on the part of those who get some of the benefits of what you've called the entitlement program, or some of, the welfare state kind of stuff?
Let's say our transfer programs of money certainly have created a disincentive for many, many people, especially those who are poor and disadvantaged in the economic chain to start with. There isn't much incentive for them to take a hold of their bootstraps and go to work and get someplace.
Or to train them so that they are able to sustain themselves in some meaningful employment.
Well, some people would say that's simply a lack of initiative, that if you really wanted to get a job in this life, I know my father-in-law used to say this, and we used to, let's just say, have spirited exchanges on this one. But if you were really willing to work, there was always, there's always a job. I remember my father's advice to me was there's always room at the top for another good one. And today, what is it at the University of Minnesota and all the PhDs in history that the last 2 years, less than 10% have gotten jobs, but anyway. Do you think is that what you're trying to say, is that because of the entitlement programs and the difficulties with the way the incentive, the reward system is handed or distributed?
Well, I believe in the dignity of labor and the exhilaration of achieving something by your own effort. And I think in many instances, we have disenchanted people in the lower segment of society who may want to have that exhilaration and sense of achievement, but they simply can't exist unless they're given something to help sustain them. But at the same time, they are not given educational or training opportunities to help them sustain themselves. And I think this is where the pity is.
Okay.
I'm thinking another side of that is that most homes, the father and mother are working.
Okay.
And there apparently is a little more money. And I can think of 30 years ago having many boys knocking on my door, "Can I shovel your walks?" can I mow your yard? Now I have to go and almost beg somebody to do this.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Yeah, that'd be a good example of what we're talking about here.
I just heard a cute little story recently. There was a 75-year-old lady, and she lived near Denver. And she went into this store one day, and she noticed that everybody was really doing a good job. So she went up to this person and said, well, I think I'd like to talk to the manager. I just want to tell them that they are running a good store. They have wonderful people here and everything. And she said, do you have a position open? And he said, yes, I do. And she said, I'd like to apply. And he said, you're just the one I'm looking for. Well, she accepted the job for 4 hours a day. And she went home after working the first 4 hours and went to bed and thought, oh, I don't think I can do this. But she slept well and she went back. But someone asked her, why did you want a job? She didn't have to work. And she said, I just wanted to prove that if anyone really wanted to work, they could get a job. And that was her motive.
Really? Up here.
Okay, there. Sure. Hi.
I think one of the pities is that young people, often in families these days, don't have an opportunity to learn of a valuable contribution they can make to the family. There are dishwashers, there are automatic washers and dryers. You don't have to hang the wash out in the line. The grass mower is too complicated, so you can't have anyone under 16 running it, and so kids don't even learn to take out the garbage. There isn't any way that they can really learn the joy of being a contributing part of the family. And I think that maybe some families have to go backwards to do things in the family to give the children a part.
I think that's an interesting point. Maybe, you know, in fact, instead of, you know, just blaming the young people all the time, maybe parents have tried to make life too easy for the children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my father didn't, I'll tell you. A day of confirmation, we always used to say, that was sort of the beginning of the new age in life. I mean, all the honeymoon and everything was over, and we went to work right after confirmation. I don't know why. He had to pick some sort of ceremonial date. But
but then you had the joy of knowing you were needed, too.
Yes, yeah. And I don't want to go back to the thing that, you know, I grew up in, it's true, I grew up during the Depression. And we just didn't have that much, you know, available for anything else, and everybody had to sort of learn to think. But it's possible that with all our labor-saving devices, that's what you're saying, and all the rest.
Well, they can't even be employed on the farm, for instance, or a lot of, you can't hire anyone under a certain age, even as a carry-out boy. I was talking to our former business manager, their son in Tacoma can't even have a paper route because it's too dangerous for him to be in the streets with his bicycle, so his parents have to drive, and they might as well do the paper route themselves as drive the boy to, I mean, all he would do would be run up to the house and collect what we drink. So there are so few ways that young people can learn.
There's an article in the Reader's Digest that says that about the breakdown in the family. That's exactly what they're saying, is that to feel a member of the family, you feel that you're responsible and you do certain tasks in the family, wash dishes, dry dishes, carry out the garbage. And that's not happening now. They don't feel this part of the family because they're not sharing the burden of the family responsibility. But I have to say, you know, from
sure.
the workplace,
yeah.
the one that you hire now, it is not the same person as my parents when they worked in the workplace. When equipment breaks down, people would stay and stay to see it through, that it is fixed and repaired. The new generation now are not that way. They are not that dedicated to their employment as my parents would be. And you can even see from a financial standpoint that kids now, from a money standpoint, they have plastic money.
Yeah.
And I can look at it from my mother's standpoint. The fear of having a credit card, because you always save and you always pay with cash.
Mm-hmm.
And so the generations economically and socially are different. It's a different world now than it was during the Depression.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to that point about identifying with your work. I mean, the one thing that I learned from my father was he was very proud. He was a Main Street independent hardware merchant, and that's the way he identified himself. And saw his whole identity was at the, about the biggest day in his life was when he'd go up to St. Paul to the, you know, the hardware convention. because he could be with other hardware dealers. And it was true. He worked 6 days a week, and on Sunday he got a headache, and we finally figured out why, because he wasn't at the store. And he identified, and it's hard, you know, what I'm trying to say on the other hand, it's hard in our more automated kind of society for younger people to identify, you know, with a product or with a job. You get into these huge bureaucracies and multinational corporations, which are the obviously what's happening. And we just saw, you know, Northwest absorbed Republic up in the Twin Cities is just one more example of, you know, mergers and all the rest of these things and the buyouts and all this. It's very hard to identify with the, you know, with the company or the goals, because it's so huge and so mammoth, and you have to learn to play, you know, the game of faculty or office politics. There's faculty politics too with this, yeah. And then I want to come back to your point, sure.
From a mill standpoint, you can see the age group before you threw nothing away. You always save something. And these people lived through the Depression, lived through the war times when things were not available. So they wouldn't throw pumps and pipes, and you ended up with warehouses literally filled with what we classify now junk. But to them, it was very important. So their philosophy was that they saved everything.
Yeah.
You didn't throw things. The philosophy now is that you operate with none of these things around. You know, if the equipment is around and it's not being used, you sell it.
Yeah.
Or you scrap it out. But in those days,
well, there's one person who still saves, and that's Emily's husband. He's he grew up during the Depression in rural Texas, didn't he? That's right. He saves everything. He's 62? Jim is 62, right. He saves everything, right. That's a good point. Thank you.
There's so many single-parent families now, and, of course, many of them are on welfare, and this is all the children know. So when they grow up and have their families, that's what they expect. And as a public welfare social worker, I get into third generations, and it'd be the same thing.
I think that was part of what we were talking about. I really figure that 28% of the children now born are born to single parents in the families.
And it makes a difference. Was there somebody else? Does anybody have a good story? I mean, these are all very important and useful things. Yeah. Emily, were you the one? I thought I saw you were pointing to somebody over here. I've got
a story from the Depression.
Sure.
Norwegian boy who was the brother of his uncle by marriage during the Depression. He had started out sailing, and he had been a sailor for quite a few years, and he got into New York City and learned how to be a hardwood floor layer. And the Depression came along, he was out. He didn't have any place to go, he was single, and came to stay with his brother up in Superior, Wisconsin, which is in the Great Depression in the most prosperous states of the rest of the country. And we had a lot of people on welfare, no jobs around anywhere. And of course, he was not eligible for welfare because he was a visitor, he wasn't a regular resident of the city. But that didn't trouble him at all. He got himself out on the sidewalk and he walked down at some houses, and some people had wooden boardwalks around the house that day. And there were some boards loose, he'd go knock on the door and say, "Hey, I'm a carpenter, I'd be happy to fix that sidewalk you got out there for a dollar." And I'd say, "Oh, gee, you know, it's been quite a long time. I guess that'd be a good idea." He'd pound the thing back in and he'd get his dollar and he'd go on, and he picked up enough money to get himself. He found out that most of the housewives needed their knives and scissors and things sharpened. So he came home and bought himself a few little tools, and he started out with that kit. And, you know, he made more money than the people who are on welfare. Mm-hmm. Just walking around town being friendly.
I'm reminded, and he's one of the best storytellers. He writes and doesn't talk like Kiro Keeler, but maybe some of you have read Russell Baker's book, Growing Up. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely, and it's a Depression story, and he grew up during the Depression, and I would recommend it for anybody. It's beautiful. He writes, of course, nobody writes better than Russell Baker. He's a regular columnist for the New York Times, and he came from a desperately poor background. He was selling, during the Depression, he was selling magazines on 100% commission. There was, you know, think about that. There was nothing in it at all for him unless he made a sale. And how many people were buying magazines during the Depression? But he made a fascinating point. His mother was a widow. Let's see, his father had died from some severe alcoholic condition, wasn't there, something else?
No,
like that?
He was diabetic.
Diabetic, that was
just
it, right.
It.
Oh, it's marvelous. Yeah, it's just, oh. And anyway, she was alone, and then there wasn't it a, have you got to the point where the fellow, he was an immigrant. Was he from Denmark? The baker who wanted to marry her?
Yes.
It was from Denmark. Anyway, he came over and he wanted to marry Russell Baker's mother, but he didn't have enough money.
Yeah.
And he was a very proud person. And that was the whole key to the whole incident, that he was so proud that he didn't want to make a commitment to her, and therefore if he failed, then he thought he had failed as a person, and that he would have failed as a husband then to her, even though obviously they were in love, and that therefore he kept postponing the wedding until he had enough money, you know, to marry, because of the pride he had in wanting to be a good provider. And tells the story, and finally that very sad ending where he finally says that everything has gone bad, and that, you know, it is a very gloomy ending, and he's just given up, kind of thing. It's not an uplift. It's not a Norman Vincent Peale kind of story at all, but it's a very telling human story, because it indicates how terribly important it was for people to have that sort of sense of being important by being reasonably successful, or at least being able to provide something. And there, you talk about credit cards. My father-in-law didn't buy a farm until he had enough money to pay for the farm. All right, it was only 80 acres down in Racine County in Wisconsin, but still it was 80 acres. And for somebody who came over to this country in 1910 with about $20 in his pocket, that was a pretty nice farm. And the only bills he ever had was Wisconsin Power and the telephone bill, because he learned that and had this enormous sense of pride that went with this. But then it was something that, you know, to come back to the point, it's easy to make those points like that, but everything, you know, he did, he could see in terms of the improvement of the productivity in the farm. And, you know, if you work for a large corporation or something like that, how much can you see in terms of what you're doing for the, you know, for the farmer? Isn't there, in Sweden where they improve productivity by giving, 18 or 20 workers, you know, all the authority and the autonomy to solve a problem in the factory themselves, and not have to check it out 2-3 times up in three, four levels of policymakers. And they got the incentive to do this, and were able to create their own solutions to the problems, and were able to identify, you know, with the product itself, rather than simply seeing themselves as virtually like Ottomans going along with this. I'm wondering if that's really possible. When you get in, because now the whole idea is, you know, like my nephew, the first thing he got out of graduate school, he got into a big law firm. That was the only way he could do anything. Look at in the medical profession, everything is towards consolidation. Now you get to be, you know, you work for a HMO somewhere and you go on a salary rather than having the old independent, doctor any longer. And what kind of incentive is there? Yeah, Diane.
Yeah, the modern age definitely tests a person's adaptability. I'm a computer systems analyst. And the challenge for that profession is, unlike a carpenter who can go out and say, I built that house, all I get to do is look at a cathode ray tube and say, 3 years of my effort has produced these little green numbers. Okay. And I think to survive in the work environment these days, we have to really break down into little tiny pieces our achievements, or else we go crazy. My projects do last 3 years. It takes that long. And so to keep myself motivated, I have to break it down a little piece and go, oh, pat myself on the back. I got this little part here done. And I work for an aerospace company. I had the privilege of going down and watching some of the mechanics work last week. And interestingly enough, they've taken out some of the automation because they have found that there are certain things that just need craftsmanship. And interestingly, the quality of the product has gone up since they let people start building the whole unit by hand themselves.
It's interesting. I want to plug it into Emily.
As a psychologist, I want to say that work binds us to reality, and that when we get too lofty in our thoughts and intellect, when we work with our hands, it's the thing that ties us to reality, just as you said.
I'd like to shift it a little bit here, and that's with so many people who can't identify with the work as easily as, say, my father-in-law or my father or myself. I like writing, as some of you know, and that's really nice to see the product come out. I like to see ink on paper is what I like to see. And, you know, you like to see something else on canvas, but that's your thing, or a dancer, or, you know, artist, whatever it might be. And that's very nice. It's just like seeing a child being born, especially when you, sometimes you're writing a book, you spend more time and more effort on the book, on the manuscript, than you do on your children. And you send it off into the world, and, you know, you want to sit down with the editor and say, isn't that great, and look at this, and isn't that a nice passage, and all the rest. And like your children, they have to survive on their own. And that's fine, because I can identify with that and, you know, get a great deal of satisfaction. But I think one reason, or one way of coping for many people, this is what I want to get at, is a, I don't know if you want to call it increased, but the enormous attention and enthusiasm and dedication people give to leisure time rather than to the work. The old work ethic really, I think, you know, for many, many people, is simply no longer possible. That's what we've been talking about here, identifying. The old work ethic isn't about you work, and you work, obviously, because you want to live for the weekend. In Minneapolis, we have a radio announcer, Steve Cannon. He says, the best day of the week is a nice way of saying exactly, you know, what I'm trying to say here, is that you live for the weekend, because Friday means you've got at least 2 days free. And sorry?
Think of day.
And that, I didn't quite...
Think of day. Thank God it's Friday.
Oh, yeah, T-G-I-F, sure. And then I always like the G, the thank God it's Friday, and then it's a good God, it's Monday, you know, club that comes along. And the absentee rate, what is it, 15% on the average in factories, I think, across the country on Monday mornings and in the country. But I think that's one way of coping, and why a lot of people don't even much care what, you know, in a very real sense, compared to, say, older people, what their job is, because they've got the weekend. And all the leisure time and all the glamour that goes along with the, you know, with the clothes and the, you know, the lifestyle that is associated with a certain kind of, you know, recreation. The health and spa clubs, give you one example. Now there's just an enormous growth industry there. Now you can wear your neat little outfits and, you know, your little red headbands and all the things that go along with, or with the jogger clothes. And I say that because I'm a biker, and all my biker friends have all their neat outfits, and they, you know, their $500-$600 bikes and all their clothes and everything that they identify with. And I just want to get out and look at the cows when I go out riding a bicycle. But they spend time with that, and that's the important thing to them. They'll work, for instance, 5 days a week at bicycle repair, so they can ride 100 miles on Saturday and 100 miles on Sunday, in what we call century bike rides. And that's good enough for them, because that the bike repair gives them the wherewithal to do what they want to do most, and they know they can't do that 7 days a week, so they're willing to do it 2 days a week and maybe sneak in a little extra, you know, along the way. And the enormous emphasis we have in this country, and I suppose Japan would be the only other country that has it, on professional sports. You identify with the sports that go with us, and all the you know, the good times that go with that. And some of you are from Seattle. Just to give you one example, I always love this comment I've heard from so many Seattle people. The two most important days in a Seattle person's life: the day they buy the boat and the day they sell the boat.
And
it's what the average is 4 to 5 years before you get the second important day of your life, and something like that. I don't know how many people have told me that up here. Yeah, Rob Brown.
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, in watching my grandparents coming over from Sicily is that my grandfather worked really, really hard. Yeah, when he was growing up in Sicily, his father was a stonemason, which would have been a very, very good job. And unfortunately, his father died before he passed on the trade to my grandfather. So my grandfather ended up being a ragman. Well, my grandfather saved up his money, came to the United States, worked really hard, same profession, but instead of collecting rag, he started collecting good junk that was worth a lot of money that I could sell to my paisanos and get it from the Americans. And I think, and then he would talk about how lazy my father was, okay? And of course, my father worked really hard in comparison to me, you know. My father complains about I'm not working as hard as he did. And I remember my dad making my brother and I go out and pull the weeds. And one day he made us move rocks from one side of the house to the other side of the house and back again to get us out of the house. And he came out the fourth time and said, well, I want you to move the rocks over this. Oh, well, we already did. We moved them back here again, so we won't have to do it anymore, Dad. But the thing is, I think a lot of it has to do with the decline in the work ethic, is that the people who came to the United States were greater risk takers, were people who wanted to grow, who wanted to be challenged. Mm-hmm. And they had a country to expand in and to grow in, and to create things. And you see that in the newer immigrants that are coming here now from the Asian countries. And I think you see it in the new entrepreneurs. I think we have more entrepreneurs in the younger generation now in this century than we've had in a lot of other times, because that's the only place where they can create or build a new frontier. And a lot of the other people who stayed in Europe were not the risk takers. We're more concerned with security and having it maybe not perfectly comfortable, but at least they felt secure and was within their comfort zone.
Yeah, I like the idea of risk. Yeah, Betty.
They're the risk takers, but my impression was they had to leave. They were poor. They had no choice. Sure, they had enough money to get on a boat. There were some people that didn't have enough money to get on a boat.
No.
That was a generation.
All my great-grandparents were starving in Norway. I mean, that was a wonderful, that was pretty good incentive, I mean, in the 1850s.
It was a risk.
Well, like, for example,
you didn't sit down and say, I'm going to take a risk, I'm going to go.
But how my grandfather married my grandmother is, he saved up his money and he bought tickets for two of Mr. and Mrs. Rigoberto, and he went to Mr. Pellegrino and says, I want to marry Josephine. And Mr. Rigoberto Pellegrino says, I tell you what, if Josephine wants to marry, you can marry her. Well, Josephine didn't want to marry my grandfather and come to the United States, because she wanted to marry Joseph, who had a good job as a gas lighter, and he would always have that job, work for the government. And so my grandfather says, why spend the money for two tickets? I said, I can't go unless I have somebody else. They don't give me back half of my money. I need to get her married. So he married my grandmother. She was 15 and she went with him. The point is, the lady had a choice. She could have come to the United States. She had the opportunity. She didn't, because she wanted the security. My grandmother was always laughing because Josephine's husband got unemployed about 5 years later because they introduced electric lamps.
Story some of you know this in off campus, and one of the original big building is sort of like a castle, like a medieval castle that's modeled after part of Mont Saint-Michel. It's about seven stories and has spires and all the things where the men shoot their arrows, you know, and all these things. And anyway, you know, it's the old myth story about the American dream of immigrants coming here and risk takers. And it was a young Norwegian by the name of Boya Bo who came over and wound up, as so many Norwegians did, in Northfield. And the arrangement had been, as soon as he got a job and a place to stay, that he'd call for his fiancée and she'd come over and get married. And they would live in America and enjoy the American dream. So he got a job as custodian in it's called Holland Hall, and had a little apartment also on the sixth floor up there where Howard and Edna Hong now, some of you know, have their Kierkegaard Library. But at that time it was the apartment for the custodian. And Boya got a picture of Holland Hall, grand castle and everything else, and all the dreams about America, the land of milk and honey and streets paved with gold and everything else. And he sent it back to his fiancée and quite rightly said, here's where I live. And of course Boya could do everything. She was in love with him and the hero and everything else. And everybody in America got castles, why not? And some of you know the old Norwegian immigrant letters. I mean, this was a very important dream for a lot of them. And she came over and she didn't go back. She married Boya anyway and stayed on. And there was, I don't know if it was a good marriage or bad marriage, but it was one indication of how you could get along with this. I'm hoping for some more good stories here. I've got a couple more. Yes.
Might tell one that's a true experience of my own. Didn't particularly strengthen my faith, but it made me humble.
Well, that's always useful.
I worked for the Soil Conservation Service for 35 years before I'm retiring last January. And some years ago, I was out to a farmer's place, and my job often was to assist the farmers in laying out and designing conservation practices that they could use and needed on their land. And I worked for this one fellow before, but on this particular fall day, we were staking out and constructing terraces on his farm. And around about 10 o'clock, he invited me in for coffee. And I thought that was funny, because I had worked with John other years, and he just never bothered to do that. But sure, I went in for coffee, and as we were talking in that, he started asking me questions about how I got into my work, what were the requirements, what schooling I had to have, that sort of thing. And he finally told me, he says, we're kind of interested in my young son, Howard, 14. He might like to, you know, have a job like yours. And I thought, well, that's fine. But then John told me why. He said, we just found out that Howard probably has rheumatic fever, and he'll never be able to work for a living.
Yes, please.
I'd like to build on this young man's story because I think we have a contemporary example of how immigrants really can make a go of it in America still. And I'm thinking of the Vietnamese who have come over here, and especially the Hmong people who are very proud. They want to work by their own effort. They don't want to accept welfare, and they'll do anything to band together in little family cell groups, and they'll take the humblest kind of work because they can make a go of it that way. And I think we can learn a great deal from those people.
Okay. That may be a generational thing in which people will say, you know, let's call them the, you know, WASPs, us white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, that we've been through that, or our ancestors have been through that. And I think a lot of times Americans feel entitled to, you know, a better life, so to speak. And the great dream, I think, for all of us is to have a better life for our children. And, you know, that's one thing European visitors noticed here, the enormous sacrifices that parents make for their children. For many, this is almost unbelievable because they will pay so much and sacrifice so much. And I know what it costs to send a child to St. Olaf's this year, since we're starting tomorrow, and that's unbelievable what that is. And I think that would help explain why, in a sense, WASPs are maybe 2-3 generations beyond the Hmong. I mean, there's no question about the enormous self-discipline and the pride that they've taken, and also the abuse they've taken, you know, with the persecution because they aren't white, and all the rest of these things that went with this. I know that's true, for instance, in St. Paul, where there's a great deal of a large number of Hmong people with that. Betty?
But the Hmongs were given support for the first 18 months to learn the language.
Yeah.
And I believe it's very necessary, and I think they should be helped. And I think they do work hard. I'm not undercutting it, but I think they need it. And that was slashed by the government a bit.
Yeah.
But we do support them for the 18 months.
I'd just like to make a few comments about work since this is Labor Day, and the last 2 years I've been working in a church-sponsored nursing home, and I've been so impressed with the people that work there. And you mentioned young people. We have people there from 20. We have 300 employees, about half of them between the age of 20 to 35. It's not pleasant work. It's hard work. And they're so dedicated, and they take such good care of the people that live there, the residents. I can hardly believe it. I hear these incidences because of budgetary, there's no overtime. They'll punch out and come back and help the patient after they punched out. And I think in America today, if we can have that kind of dedication in our church home, we are doing something right.
It comes down to personal dedication or personal commitment to something and how you encourage that.
It permeates the whole place.
Yeah. And sometimes it can be done, you know, through churches. We all think and know the stories about, you know, hardworking Mormons, for instance. For instance, my former wife directed the dissertations at the University of Minnesota of two Mormon scholars. They came in before 7 and they didn't leave till everything was done, and they saw to it, you know, for instance, if there's bad weather, that she got a car started or whatever it was, and they took care of all the rest of these things. Some of the others just came in and, you know, watched the clock and put in the minimum amount of work. And they never asked her anything. They never thought this was a big deal or anything special at all. But she couldn't help but notice, obviously, that these people were, you know, different in that particular sense. And she was, you know, very, very, very impressed with them. And they've just simply gone on with this kind of dedication. That's remarkable. And obviously, I was talking to somebody about, I don't know who I talked about today, saying I was going to talk about this. And obviously, if you wound up in Salt Lake City in 1846, you needed all the work ethic you could get, obviously, to, you know, to survive. And many of you have been in Salt Lake City, and you know how remarkable that story has been, with some obvious, you know, difficulties. But the sense of personal dedication and involvement, I wonder how, you know, for those of you who've had the same experience, you know, have you found ways in which this works? If you've worked with people where you can encourage, you know, a sense of personal commitment?
Well, I think the whole area of volunteerism points to this. In America, it's unique. half the agencies and half the institutions are run by volunteers who, whose only remuneration is satisfaction for the work they're doing.
And that, you know, I'm just wondering if there's some way or some ways in which we can sort of in strengthen that or encourage that or let other people know how it's been done. How do you think, you know, why do you think it works there at that hospital or that home where you are, Howard?
Oh, I think it's the, as I told you this morning, with college professors and church institutions, they're overworked and undertaken.
Yeah.
Completely dedicated to their job, and yeah. I think there's a lot of Christianity that goes with them.
Yeah.
And their faith that carries them a great deal.
Yeah.
We don't hire people on that basis, of course
no.
We can't, but I think the management, once they set the theme or the feeling of that nature and they see the type
yeah.
of work they may work that way. I've also had exposure in industry where it's quite the opposite.
Yeah.
But,
it takes some input from the top to do that. I mean, to create some incentive and some rewards and bonuses along the way, and not just to have just the relationship of the paycheck with that sort of thing, which is difficult for some people to do, because you know in our system the idea is that you put in so much time and you get so much work and that's the end of it, and that's a far cry from what you know what you're talking about is going on there, and I think if
maybe a little different than along the line we're talking about. I think it kind of fits in.
Please.
I think it was about 6-7 years ago we went to China, and it was the year they announced normalization over there. We happened to be right in Shanghai the day when it was announced. But we had for a guide, we had a young lady who was a graduate from the Peking University. She had never seen an American. We were the first ones that she'd seen in her life. She always, every now and then would look at us and see what round eyes you have and what long noses you have. But anyway, we were finally going on a train going to another city, and some reason or other she took a kind of a liking to my wife, and so she asked whether she could sit with us. So we were on the train and going along. I had a good chance to say some things about the Christian faith, and she wanted to know what Christmas was when I said Christmas, and when I said Easter, she wanted to know what that was, and so on. And finally, I tried to tell her what was good about America, you know. She was really interested, and I said, you know, it's one place where you can really succeed on your own, really, really succeed. And I told her the story of my father, who came from Germany when he was just a boy, got here with 50 cents in his pockets, took the only job that was available, and that was on a farm, and he was not a farmer at all, but he took it and worked his way up, and I told her about how he finally worked hard, you know, from 4 a.m. and harvest till 11 p.m, and finally was able to marry my mother after he had enough money. And then they worked hard, and they bought 80 acres, and they worked harder, and then finally had the children. And then they worked hard because they wanted those children to have an education. And so on I went. And at that time, somebody tapped her on the shoulder, one of the other guides, and said, you have some responsibility you need to take care of. So she went away. And then she came back after about a half hour and sat down again. She said, tell me, why do you work so hard in America? I had described this whole process of my father and how he... Well, I said, you know, my father had nothing when he... the old country, he wanted to own some things. He wanted a car he could call his own. He wanted a home that he could call his own. He wanted children that would have a chance to be educated. He went through 7 grades, that's as far as he got. So on I went on to tell her about why my father worked so hard. He wanted all of his kids to have an education. We all got a college education, so on. And then she paused for a moment, looked straight at me. She says, I thought so. In America, you work so hard to get things for yourself. You want your own things yourself. You want your own family to have things better. Matsi Tung has taught us to serve the people. That's number one. We work so hard to serve our people. You work hard to have your own family succeed. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't sleep too well that night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess, really, as a Christian, we're here to serve the people.
Mm-hmm.
I might just add in my close that I realize that in China, they aren't exactly working to serve the people either, but at least they're taught. That's the important thing.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's interesting. One of the examples we've all used here is the people who came over and got fired, and you know, made a success of this. And all I have to say is, think of the hard work and the incredible, you know, self-discipline and everything that goes into farming today, and what should I say reversal it is for farmers. And the old rules simply don't work anymore. The old incentives simply are gone. You all have your own stories. I'm sure you could tell, and I could tell stories about my relatives out at Holden who are doing everything they've always done before, and they're losing their shirt. And it's very, very difficult. And some of you from Iowa, for instance, or it's even much worse in places like that. So there are, what I'm trying to say is that there are examples of people who are really, you know, seriously victims of, you know, forces, you know, beyond their control, and how difficult it is. And I was delighted to see that they set up in the Twin Cities, they set up a joint sort of a hotline and an advisory board between the Roman Catholics and the Lutherans in southwestern Minnesota, in a very, very remarkable joint cooperative effort on the part of the two largest, you know, denominations in southern Minnesota to do whatever they could. And I know I can't speak for the other ones, and I'm sure they're active, but I know it's been very active in southern Minnesota with the ALC for getting involved with the life of the parish, because the farmers are in a desperate kind of situation. And we've got somebody, I don't know if you know Ann Canton, who's from St. Olaf, who's done everything. She just dedicated herself to this. And if you ever have the chance to listen to her, I mean, you'll get up and want to march and follow wherever she leads when she gives a talk about living on the land and the dedication and what it means, you know, for identification with this oil and all that goes along with this. It's a
that's a good forum for church forum.
Yeah.
They also have a videotape that's excellent on that subject.
Good. I see a few heads are being slowly lowered back and forth towards the up and down of your anatomy, so maybe we should call it quits, and I thank you all for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.